Welcome to the Upper Hand Podcast, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all things hand surgery related, from technical to personal.
Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And thank you in advance for leaving a review and leaving a rating wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hey, Chris.
Hey, Chuck. How are you?
I'm really good. I'm glad to be back at it with you, talking about your favorite subject.
You know, I do like nerve, guilty as charged, and I can't believe I've dragged you into another three-part, maybe four-part series about nerves, and we're in the middle of our radial nerve series. So are you enjoying it so far?
I'm enjoying every second of it, and I think it's great. So today we're going to talk about nerve transfers, specifically radial nerve transfers, which I think for the audience will be helpful. Many of us know a bit more about transfers for dealing with other areas, and radial nerves, I believe, seem a little newer. And then we're going to talk about tendon transfers, where I can contribute a little bit more. And then Macy has agreed and is excited about talking about therapy after tendon or nerve transfers.
Great. Well, I see that Macy took the reply tactic as opposed to the reply all tactic in terms of our inquiry. So I'm excited. I didn't know if she had agreed or not. She always does. It's just a matter of finding the time. So, I mean, before we jump into nerve transfers, I mean, what do you think the role is of, exploring nerves? We talked a little bit about that, early in the last episode about, in the setting of something that occurs potentially iatrogenically, and there's a question of whether the nerve is intact. But do you think that there's a role for nerve exploration and grafting? That was something that before nerve transfers came up and, is and was an option before tendon transfers.
Yes, I have to make an editorial comment before I jump into that. When you talk about reply all, I don't know about you, but one of my pet peeves are needless reply all when there's like 100 people on the email. And I seem to be getting those regularly. And it is certain people that do it. So I know it's not you. I hope it's never me. Anyways, I had to get that off to my chest.
There were three people on the email. I don't think that's a needless reply all, but
not that one.
I'm happy to have less email. That's fine with me as long as the job gets done.
I mean, the ones that's like, have a good Thanksgiving or whatever. And then like all of a sudden everyone's saying to 100. Anyways, okay, back on.
Yeah, but before we get into that, I have started to use the tactic of the BCC for large groups, which neutralizes the reply all heavy people.
Proactive. One of the surgeries I enjoy most and have seen really good results with is the autograft for radial nerve injury, whether that be ballistic, iatrogenic, or just sharp laceration. I think the autograft interpositional cable graft can be really effective. I think it's for the reason you mentioned on our first episode is the distance required for the nerve to recover to start re-innervating muscle is shorter, but I like that procedure.
Yeah, and I think physiologically it makes a lot of sense why that works better than for median and ulnar. And I think that, that surgery is probably one that is not done as much as it used to be, and it probably should continue to be done. The person who would be doing that surgery is probably now the person who's considering nerve transfers. That being said, doing nerve transfers does get you closer to target. Depending on where you are with your injury, you may not be able to restore things like wrist extension fully with a nerve transfer. And you can see that many of the people that are doing the nerve transfers are also combining it with a PTDE-CRB tendon transfer at the same time, which I think is a very reasonable and appropriate thing to do. And you can also plug into the ECRB nerve, but you're not going to get the ECRL nerve because we know that that innervation tends to come in higher up, sometimes even above the elbow, in terms of where it comes off the radial nerve. I think the hard part about the nerve grafting bit is that you really don't know how much to cut out and where to cut it out. You're going a lot based on look and feel and a lot of dogmatic kind of stuff. So that's what makes a very tough decision.
I have two questions. The first is I'd like you to talk about allograft versus autograft in this situation. And we'll paint the picture of a 45-year-old male with a gunshot wound, injury to his radial nerve, which occurred, 6 weeks ago. So that's one question, autograft versus allograft. And talk about positioning on the table. If you favor an autograft, kind of how you think about that and what you do with positioning the lower extremities.
So I have bias. I tend not to use, I don't use allograft for mixed or motor nerves. There are probably some stones being thrown at me from some colleagues across the country. But I don't think the data is there. I know that there are some papers that are published. I don't think they're the highest quality evidence. And I will leave it by stating that I think there's a lot of bias in what goes into that database. But it is prospectively collected. I get it. I understand allograft is a convenient choice. And a good choice in a lot of situations. For me, I'm not using it for mixed or motor. I get that other people do. So that's the first question. For me, it's autograft. And then to the second question for positioning, I like doing this kind of case if we're going to do an autograft in the lateral position with either on a bump in the arm, the affected arm hanging over the bump, or on an arm holder, and that gives you access to the ipsilateral lower extremity for harvesting your nerve in a position that's not going to give you cervicalgia.
I learned a new word, cervicalgia.
But it's in the old ICD-9 and 10. No worries there, I promise.
I don't want it. I know that. I don't want it. I like the positioning though, and for other nerves, like if you're doing a median nerve, autograft, that kind of supine positioning is really tough. I think for the radial nerve, it is easier because lateral is just a simpler approach.
Yeah, because honestly, even if you're doing, say, for example, humeral shaft fracture or a distal humerus fracture, many people will position at a lateral position anyway, just because it is easier to get to where you need to go on the humerus and onto the nerve. Now, if you're trying to combine nerve grafting and nerve transfers, which I have done in, I think, one or two patients, what I've done there is position them initially in that position, but also tell the OR staff that we're going to then deflate the beanbag and roll out into a supine position with a hand table. But the hand table obviously isn't there to start for the nerve transfer part of it. The other thing you can do for exploration, if you're not anticipating a nerve graft and you're just trying to neuralize, is to do it supine, but take one of the arm holders that you or one of your colleagues would use for like a shoulder scope case, put it on the opposite side of the table and use that as to hold the arm across the chest. I found that pretty helpful for this kind of exposure, as well as even for like a triceps to axillary nerve transfer. If you just want to stay supine and you don't want to go prone, for example, if you either don't like going prone, patient can't go prone, or you think you might have to do some work from anterior as well.
Good suggestions all. I'll say that to put it back to sports a little bit, I do a lot of elbow arthroscopy and will often combine procedures. And when doing so, I will do a lot of different things through that in that lateral decubitus position over an arm holder. And one of them is transpose the ulnar nerve. And certainly the anatomy is different. The precautions are different. But you can get it done and done safely and done well and done expeditiously. But it is a little bit of an acquired skill to get comfortable with the different positioning.
I've had to do that, especially when helping colleagues who are already in the OR and going to do other things. And there's nothing like doing one of your favorite surgeries upside down.
That's exactly right. All right.
It keeps you on your toes for sure. Well, and the last thing I could add is that I haven't done this yet, but one thing I learned at my visit to the Mayo Clinic is that I think it's for the spider arm holder set. They actually have a leg attachment to hold the leg. For sural harvesting, if you are so inclined, you're doing that in a supine position. I have not found that set yet. I haven't needed it yet, but it's a good thing to keep in mind.
I'm old school. I usually hold the leg for somebody else to harvest, but I like that there's solutions to these challenges. Right. All right. So talk to me about your personal indications for radial nerve transfers.
So I think that it's got to be, like at many nerve transfer things, it's got to be the right patient. Somebody who is willing to put in the time, knowing that it's going to take probably 9 months for the lights to come on at least to start to see some reinnervation after a nerve transfer. And then probably 12 months to really see what kind of, response or reinnervation they're going to get and 15 months to see it mature. So it is a big time investment for, I think a functional outcome that can be fantastic. I saw a patient back in clinic on Monday who was 15 months out. You cannot tell the difference between his two sides. It's amazing. So huge upside. But you know, it's a very long time to wait. And you have to have the calculus of factors that is favorable to nerve regeneration. So a young patient typically is better, a non-smoker, somebody who's generally healthier, and somebody who has the willingness, the personality, and the resources to go to therapy. And not only to go to therapy, but to also do the exercises at home. Now, that collection of factors does not often come together in one particular patient, and you're lucky if you get most of them. But that's the biggest thing. And then the injury itself has to be amenable to it. Musculotendinous needs to be in good shape. Can't be tons of trauma in that area. Obviously has to have good donors. So typical suite of nerve transfers for this would be for median to radial. Would, you know, classically described by Dr. McKinnon, was FCR to PIN and FDS to ECRB. Dr. Bertelli does things a little bit different, but when he does it, he also typically now, I believe, will add the AIN-PQ branch, the distal AIN, he calls it, and transfer that directly into the deep portion of the PIN, which is essentially going to the first compartment, you know, as opposed to the finger extensors, this one targeting the thumb.
Nice.
Well, hey, before we get any further, we should talk about our friends over at PracticeLink.
Absolutely. The Upper Hand is sponsored by PracticeLink.com, the most widely used physician job search and career advancement resource.
Becoming a physician is hard, but finding the right job does not have to be. Join PracticeLink for free today at www.practicelink.com.
Talk to me about two different things. One, when you would consider adding that pronator teres, ECRB splinting transfer in this situation. And then two, let's talk a little bit about technical for your preferred transfers.
Sure. I tend to follow Dr. McKinnon's advice because I think it's a good one to add the tendon transfer at the same time, because you're not going to want to go back typically, because to do that tendon transfer, you will be in the area where you're close enough to where you've done your nerve transfers, where it's going to affect your willingness to go back and do what is a very solid and reliable tendon transfer, the PTD, ECRB, or ECRL, wherever you want to put it. You tend to weave it into the side. And patients do like having that internal splint. And hopefully, whatever you get from the nerve transfer will augment that. I think that, you know, one consideration that needs to be stated is that one of the reasons why people don't do nerve transfers is because they have concerns about sacrificing a future donor. So, you know, if you, you know, you're already doing your PTD, ECRB tendon transfer, that, so that's good if you're doing it at the same time. But then you don't want to lose innervation to your FCR if you want to do that for an EDC tendon transfer, or some people use FCU. That's clearly not going to be affected here, and your overall risk flexion power may decrease. And then you don't want to affect too much of your FDS function, because that could be a great donor as well. That being said, there are more redundant fascicles than the textbook describes in terms of branches coming off to the FCR, branches coming off to the FDS. And I think it is helpful, you know, as you're doing the surgery, to dissect out multiple branches and make sure that you have multiple portions of the median nerve that are innervating the things that you are potentially sacrificing. Because taking a fascicle that goes to FCR, one that goes to FDS, is totally fine as long as you still have another one going into it. And sometimes even if you don't, but I think it is helpful to check.
Okay, perfect. For those of you who don't live in this world, Chris is giving an incredible amount of information in a very short period of time. So I'm probably going to have to rewind to listen to this, because this is not the world I live in. I live in the pronator teres to ECRB world, but the rest of it a little less.
And I can't wait to hear your pearls on that, because that I think is that's a hard surgery to do really well. And then to add that into a bunch of other stuff, just, you know, it doesn't get the credit it deserves.
One question about the PT to ECRB for you is when the radial nerve transfers recover, I agree that you will get better wrist extension. Do you ever get wrist flexion back? And I'll say, I never really care about wrist flexion, honestly, because we don't do much in wrist flexion. But do you lose that permanently in this patient population?
I think you do. You lose some because you spend so much time focusing on wrist extension. I admit, I honestly don't really ask. Because, you know, for the reasons you stated, but I think there are some patients that get very focused on numbers and perfection. At that point, typically our therapy colleagues have steered them towards thinking about extension more than anything else, especially if they've had a surgery intentionally for extension. And that brings me to the point that, you know, you talk about indications. when I see somebody in clinic, if I'm fortunate enough to have either Macy in clinic or Jamie Findice in clinic with me, or Kathy Dom, who lives in this world and understands these patients, I ask them as a colleague, and I say, can you go see this patient? Let me know what you think. So I did that in clinic recently with Jamie, and she saw a patient, and I left the room saying, I want you to talk to our therapy expert, because I'm not sure which one you're going to want to pick. And she had an answer for me as soon as I walked back in. So it was great. And we decided that patient would be better off with tenant transfers. So I think that's a huge part of it, because they'll get a sense of patient goals, expectations, what the recovery trajectory will look like, leveling with the patient. And I think that's a hugely important piece.
I love that. It's so true. The collaboration and partnership is really important. All right, let's talk a little technical. So we'll maybe not talk about PT to ECRB, because we can hit that in the tenant transfer segment, which will follow this one. But let's talk about your other nerve transfers. Just take us through them, specifically what you do and how you do it.
So you are going to rely on a nerve stimulator typically to help you. So there are a couple things that go with that. So you need to ask your anesthesiologist not to give any long-acting paralytics, because that can affect how well you're able to stimulate. Short-acting for induction, totally fine, should be gone by the time you are working. Placement of your tourniquet, it tends to be that we think that tourniquet-related ischemia occurs at least half an hour after the tourniquet comes up. Sometimes it can go even longer. It's actually something that we're studying right now. But you need to be very efficient as you dissect. I mean, literally, like, you talk about the entire plan, you tell the OR, like, I'm going to be kind of on edge for the first 30 to 45 minutes as we're getting started, because I need to get these things done. I will, with most trainees, I will actually write out the entire list of steps that need to happen and give them a schedule in which this is going to happen. Because I prefer to do this dissection under tourniquet as much as I can, because I think that 30 to 45 minutes under a tourniquet saves me probably an extra 30 to 45 minutes if I wasn't doing it under a tourniquet. So typically I am the one leading the dissection in this particular scenario. I do make the curve S-shaped incision that Dr. McKinnon describes. The S of it kind of depends on what I'm trying to do and where I'm trying to go. I think you can even incorporate the Bertelli addition to this transfer from anterior only, although sometimes going dorsal will be helpful for that. And then, you know, it is speed dissection. So the things you need to get out, you need to decompress and expose the median nerve. You need to get out your donors and stimulate your donors to make sure they're healthy. So that typically involves, you know, decompressing the lacertus, getting the median nerve out, getting to the FDS arch. And at that point, you'll have seen the branches coming off of the median nerve, obviously being very careful with them. You'll have seen the AIN itself, making sure you protect that. Then you need to identify those, tag those, and then you need to get to your targets. Some people go to the targets first, but you need to get to your targets to make sure they are indeed not responding. So exposing your radial nerve, I tend to use the superficial radial nerve as a guide, just even though it's dissecting more distally, coming more proximally, that's a relatively expeditious dissection to get back to the radial nerve proper. Find ECRB branches coming up before the PIN comes off, finding the PIN. You can dive right to the radial nerve and go to the PIN. I just find the SRN to be a very helpful guide. Doesn't take me much longer and saves my frustration.
I think that's well said, and I totally agree with you. I mean, I don't do nerve transfers because I like to send them to you. But when I decompress the radial nerve, I tend to go dorsally now. But when I go volarly, I love that approach, and it's so easy to find the superficial branch and trace it back. So big S-shaped volar incision and start to identify your targets, and just take us through the two main focus areas for your nerve transfers.
So in terms of the targets, you typically want something that's going to provide wrist extension. So to augment your tendon transfer. So there tends to be an ECRB branch that comes off close to where the SRN and the PIN are branching. If not, sometimes a trifurcation, sometimes it comes off the SRN, sometimes it comes off the PIN, sometimes it comes in even higher up. Just being aware of those variations. I think that the more dissections you do, the more comfortable you are identifying that branch and getting used to its size. These are things that you clearly do not want to blow through and cauterize and all that kind of stuff, because you need them. So I think finding that and then finding the PIN, and, you know, you can find some branches to the supinator that come off before the PIN gets deeper into the underneath the fascia. And those are helpful to use in other settings, but can be helpful to use for finding your PIN proper. And then I do a complete radial tunnel release, but usually I'll wait to do that decompression until I've gotten everything done that needs to be done under tourniquet in the first 30 minutes. So when I'm setting the timer, when the tourniquet's going up, I ask the anesthesiologist to set it for every 10 minutes to go off so that I know. I actually will write down the time that we start the case on the drapes so I can keep in mind. And as I glance up at the clock on the wall, I kind of know where I am. And, you know, it is, you know, kind of a, you know, time trial, which part of me enjoys until I stop enjoying it. But once that's done, then I take a deep breath, we can relax and then finish the case. But in terms of the median, I think finding the orientation, you know, the branches coming off, it's always good to practice that when you're doing median nerve decompressions in the forearms, just more reps with that anatomy and seeing it. And then you have the benefit of having, typically, you should be having a healthy donor and using your nerve stimulator to help you. Dr. McKinnon has some really nice topography maps that have been helpful to me, but it honestly is just more kind of visual memory as you, the more cases you do.
I love it. That's a great overview. And what's your, do you have one or two key articles that will be helpful for those who may have done some of these but want to refresh the technique?
Right. So I think that Zach Ray and Susan McKinnon wrote the first article on this, and that's a great technique article. That's in JHS, and we can put that in the show notes. I'll pull it up and send it to you. And then I think the modification that Bertelli added is very useful. And I think the rationale for that modification was that when he studied his results, both from nerve transfers and tendon transfers, he noted that there was a lag in the thumb MP extension. So typically that the first compartment wasn't getting reinnervated enough. And, you know, so he went back to the lab, as he is a great anatomist, and, you know, looked at the branching pattern. And it's been described before, but there tends to be a component of the PIN on the dorsal side that splits off, that he called a deep PIN, you know, and goes to the first compartment, goes to the third compartment, and then the superficial part tends to go to the EDC and the ECU. So that's super helpful. And then you're able to transfer directly into that deep branch. And the thing that reaches is the AIN, the same nerve you would get for a supercharge. So the PQ branch, and you can actually pluck that nerve, either you can get it from dorsal, if you're dorsal, by working through the interosseous membrane, or you can just find it volarly, since you typically are that distal anyway with your dissection with the pronator teres. Tendon transfer, and just get it volarly. It honestly is easier to find it volarly. You just want to make sure that you're dividing it after the FPL receives this last innervation, which typically are. It's just something to think about as you're neuralizing it proximally to get your swing distance. These are super fun transfers. Definitely something that you want to practice in the lab first, though, for sure.
I love that. I can tell the audience, without a doubt, nothing will make Chris happier than getting questions about this technique. So email us at handpodcast@gmail.com. Reach out to us on social media. And otherwise, I think we should wrap this one up.
Yeah, I think it'd be great to hear more about the tendon transfer part of it. As this series comes out, it'd be great to address any listener questions in a wrap-up as well. So hopefully this will be a fun holiday treat for all.
Perfect. Take care. Thanks.
All right. You too.
Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter at Hand Podcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is at Congenital Hand. What about you?
Mine is at Chris DMD, spelled DY. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand and come back next time.